Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 23rd, 2016. Today, as usually we are, we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. Good to have you here. And we're happy to be joined for a second time by Fran McIntyre, who's a lawyer, substantial experience in litigation. She's working at the firm of Kaplis, Connors, and Carroll, and she's with us to talk about the significant legal news that came in last week about the SJC decision on the Global Warming Solutions Act. So let me take a crack at putting everyone back on the same page about the Global Warming Solutions Act and what the Supreme Judicial Court did. So the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts is the highest, it's the equivalent of the federal Supreme Court, right? It's the highest court in the land. A foundation called the Conservation Law Foundation, which is a legal environmental group, sued the state government over a law called the Global Warming Solutions Act, because inside that law, inside the Global Warming Solutions Act, there were essentially targets set for carbon dioxide emissions reductions. And the debate that has floated around the State House for the last 10 years or so is whether or not those carbon dioxide emissions targets were aspirational or were they mandated? Do they have to be met by law? And it turns out that I think the Supreme Judicial Court came down and said essentially those carbon emissions reductions targets had to be mandated and had to be met by the state or else they were breaking the law. So, D.R., let me put you on the spot first. Is that your interpretation as well?
Definitely my interpretation, and definitely a clarion call to action and aggressive action by the state to do as much as possible to curb carbon pollution, and a ruling that could make Massachusetts an international leader, not just a national leader, but an international leader on clean energy, because the only way you can comply with the tenets of this ruling is to deploy as much clean energy as possible. So it could be a game changer in terms of how far Massachusetts goes in terms of clean energy.
So Fran, let me ask you, can you remind us what the implications are for the climate movement and the state government and sort of energy policy that surround this? I mean, what's happened? Where are we different today? And what should we look for going forward?
Well, I think I would just clarify a little bit that the ruling of the court was simply for the setting of the limits. The ruling of the court is not that the state reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by an X date. That's provided for under the Global Warming Solutions Act, but that wasn't the ruling of the court. The ruling of the court was narrow. It's just one small section of this act that I believe is pretty enormous, just section 3D, and it ordered the state to publish regulations addressing multiple sources or categories of sources of greenhouse gas emissions, impose a limit on emissions that may be released, limit the aggregate emissions, and cause those emissions to be limited on an annual basis. So it's simply the start of the process of setting the regulatory framework, setting a concrete ceiling, and then how that will be effectuated and how that will be enforced is not entirely clear. The department, of course, and the executive branch have complete discretion as to how they go about doing that within the meaning of the law. But the ruling this week was simply that their first obligation is to set those limits, to set those hard limits, as opposed to what they were doing before, which was taking various initiatives that they were claiming were providing progress. Right. But there's not progress. It's not what the GWSA requires. It's a concrete ceiling is what's required.
And so I guess from my perspective, once the state sets a concrete limit on carbon dioxide emissions, and of course everyone listening to this podcast knows that carbon dioxide emissions are tightly bound with fossil fuel burning, which is tightly bound with the economy. I mean, once you set a limit on that, it seems to me that the state government has responsibility to find a way to meet those targets through regulation that is the least onerous, the least damaging to the economy, right? That seems to me the task at hand. And I don't know if anyone here has got an answer, but it seems like that the implementation of regulations has to be done thoughtfully, but with rules that go outside of command and control.
Right? Well, to me, and I'm not an expert in this area of science or in this particular agency's area of expertise, but it seems as though it sets limits that then must be enforceable, and exactly the framework of how it will be enforceable and how that will be carried out would seem to, over the course of time, if these limits are enforced and violations are sanctioned and permits are revoked or financial sanctions are brought about, it would at least, cause reduction just by reason of coercion, I suppose, mm-hmm. against mm-hmm. these various sources. Right. And then there may be other ways that the state or the DEP will look to reduce and meet these guidelines over time, because there certainly will be other avenues that they will look to. But that's I see is what's reached here.
So DR, you're familiar with something called the Omnibus Energy Bill that's making its way through this Massachusetts State House, which is sort of independent of the Global Warming Solutions Act, although it's within the context of these new limits and regulations. Do you have any idea how this new SJC ruling will be, shall we say, comprehended by the legislature? And would any of that be included? Would any effort to satisfy the Supreme Judicial Court make its way into the Omnibus Energy Bill? And of course, that's a lot of gobbledygook, but it sounds like, will the State House sort of demand more wind power kind of thing?
It's a very good question, and it certainly should. Certainly, the Omnibus Bill should include more incentives to expand onshore and offshore wind, to expand solar energy, to finally get rid of these ridiculous net metering caps, which are not needed. We need as much solar as possible, mm-hmm. not as little. Should also include some incentives to put some more electric vehicles on the road, presumably some tax incentives to get more people to buy electric vehicles or more, emissions-free vehicles.
But I guess, my question is, do you think that the people in the State House feel any ownership for meeting the regulations? Or can they just sort of shrug and say, it's Governor Baker's problem, DEP, let us know how it turns out, kind of thing?
Well, put it this way, if they hear from their constituents, they'll feel an incentive to make bill is as strong as possible. What do we say all the time? Power concedes nothing without a demand. You won't be able to get clean power without a demand.
I guess it's an interesting question because all of a sudden, with great, great opportunities come great responsibility, right? How do you now manage the way going forward, right, friend?
Oh, it's enormous when you think about the implications. It would seem to me that the resources required to meet the enforcement obligations, the inspection obligations, whatever hearings will be called for in terms of enforcement, to say nothing of the litigation it's undoubtedly going to provoke. It would seem to me to be a tremendous call for resources here. I would think that they're going to need more personnel and funding in order to really fully carry out what, let's remember, was the Global Warming Solutions Act passed by the legislature back in 2007. So to carry that out, right. It would seem to me they're going to need more resources than they have now.
Does that then become a political liability, right? Part of the appeal for me of something like a carbon tax is that it's revenue neutral. Everyone gets money back from a carbon tax. It effectively puts limitations on carbon burning because people, you know, there's money associated with it. Mm-hmm. If on the other hand, we have, I can just imagine the Boston Herald going crazy over how many new, you know, Enviro Nazis they have to hire to march around and shut down people's power plants. I mean, it's the opportunity for demagoguery is huge. So I guess the question from a Climate Hawk perspective, how do we manage this gift we've been given, this great opportunity, right? But you have to do the right thing with it.
Well, number one, it raises the question of how many people will be influenced by denialist propaganda. And I would submit that there's not a great deal of people who can be influenced by that. I think the issue is more about how many people who understand the importance turn out to make their voices heard in terms of letting their elected officials know that they want action on this. In terms of the political implications, I think that, you know, savvy elected officials will be able to say to their constituents that, hey, this is a golden opportunity to create as many jobs as possible in clean energy, that you can, you know, whatever the unemployment rate currently is, you can ramp it down by expanding clean energy, by expanding, you know, the opportunities for more people to put up some solar panels and to, again, you know, buy some electric vehicles. They can save money on gas, because obviously, if you're getting electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles, you're spending less on gas. This is a ruling that can generate tremendous economic benefits for the state. And when we talk about how regulations can lead to economic innovation, court rulings can lead to economic innovation. Look, I mean, if you think about it, if you think about Massachusetts versus EPA in 2007, how that led to the Clean Power Plan and how that led to the amount of clean energy jobs that will likely be created as a result of that ruling, this could be a localized version of that. This could make our economy almost, you know, when you talk about how vibrant California's economy is, we could have an economy much more vibrant than California. We could be, again, I have said it before and I'll say it again, an international clean energy leader, a model. You know, we can stop looking to Denmark and Germany and all these other countries. We can look right here at home to show how it can be done.
We'll have blog posts that say Massachusetts made 115% of its energy.
Okay, remember the old slogan, "Make it in Massachusetts," from about 30 years ago. We should bring that back.
So let's just back the scope off a little bit. We've got this SJC ruling has very consequential. Consequences, I guess, which is what consequences are. But I mean, at the federal level, there's also the president's Clean Power Plan, and some news happened there this week, which is, I don't know, somewhat perplexing. But maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. So, DR, let me put you on the spot to tell us what happened in the with the President Obama's federal Clean Power Plan, the CPP. At the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, I think that's the word. What happened to
DR? Actually, it's the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Oh, okay.
And it's an interesting delay of game that was announced, that the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals announced on its own that oral arguments for the case over the Clean Power Plan will not take place on June the 2nd. They will take place on September the 27th. And it will not be a three-judge panel. It will be the entire en banc panel of the court's judges, which I believe are 11 judges in total. They're going to hear this case, and it's going to be very, very interesting because, according to thinkprogress.org, the breakdown of the en banc panel appears to have a majority of judges who may be inclined favorably towards the Clean Power Plan. Now, TheHill.com explains how this will play out. Quoting TheHill.com, quote, "The Supreme Court halted the Clean Power Plan earlier this year and said it cannot be enforced until all the litigation surrounding it is complete. If the United States Senate does not confirm Merrick Garland as a replacement for the late Antonin Scalia or another Ninth Supreme Court justice and the court's eight justices remain, the court could easily reach a 4-4 tie when the case reaches the Supreme Court, in which case whatever the circuit court's decision is would stand." So in other words, if the D.C. Circuit, as currently constituted, upholds the Clean Power Plan, then the appeal goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court either is tied at 4-4, or there's a fifth justice that upholds the Clean Power Plan, then the Clean Power Plan is the law of the land. So it's fascinating how this could all play out. And there's obvious political implications, because this depends on whether or not there will be an appointment coming off the election, the presidential election, or whether or not that certain appointment will be blocked, and whether or not we'll still have 8 Supreme Court justices, and will those 8 Supreme Court justices deadlock 4-4 if the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals upholds the Clean Power Plan? So it's a fascinating state of affairs.
So Fran, tell me, what do you, when you look in the crystal ball, why did these 9 people in their black robes, why did they sort of take this action? Do you see as the background?
Well, the background on it is that the this actually, I think, is a good move. I think it's actually good news. I think it's going to expedite things. In the normal course, this case would have been heard by a 3-judge panel, and then the losing party, before they could take it to the Supreme Court, would go before the en banc panel of 9 judges. And in this case, apparently, a majority of the regular judges can make a determination as to whether a specific case is important enough that it should go directly to the en banc panel, and that's what they did. They voted apparently.
It's sort of like
themselves.
A subcommittee from a subcommittee up to the whole committee of the whole.
That's right.
They all get together and they make a final.
It would have been a random 3, but the whole court, a majority of them, decided that it should go to the 9 judge panel. And so they took it off for June 2nd, but they just entered the order on May 16th.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the order was that, just as a point of interest, that the parties come up with another 25 sets of briefs of what had been filed for the June 2nd hearing in order to surely distribute to the other 6 judges, plus a whole cadre of law clerks, I'm sure. Then they've all got to get in a full command of the plan and the background and the pleadings and the arguments before they have the hearing. So that's why the hearing would necessarily have to go off until everybody was up to speed and ready to hear it.
Because they couldn't get all 9 people up to speed by the original June 2nd date.
Then you've got everybody's going on vacation. It's Washington. Yeah. So it's really realistically going to be September 27th.
Uh-huh.
But what it does mean is it eliminates the delay that would have been caused if it was a 3-judge panel that was hearing it.
Right.
But I think what it does do, as DR rightly predicts, it means that there'll be no decision out of the Court of Appeals probably before January.
Right.
I mean, you've
got
to figure it's going to be 90 to 120 days. So then it's January. And then depending on, you know, how the election's gone, whether or not the Senate decides to defer action,
depending on
who wins, or whether they're going to see whoever's on somebody's short list as to who they're going to get appointed, or whatever kind of judgments they make at that point. But it would strike me that I have no idea whether or not there would be a full complement of judges by the time it got there, but this is certainly not bad news. It's somewhat more expeditious, I think.
Right. And just to remind everybody, to remind myself, I believe that the issue here is that the court issue is that the, shall we say, the oil industry claims that the EPA has misinterpreted a section of the Clean Air Act that gave to the EPA the power to do this funny kind of CPP plant. And is that right, Fram? Is it in 25 words or less? What's the crux of the legal discussion? What's the decision going to hinge on?
It's going to come down to statutory construction, not unlike the case that we just talked about in Massachusetts. It's going to be, what do the words mean?
Uh-huh.
The situation is a little bit different in the CPP, because in the act that they're relying upon, there are 2 separate provisions that are contradictory to one another. One came out of the House, one came out of the Senate, and somehow, by some remarkable accident, they both showed up in the final bill. And so the EPA is relying on one of those provisions, and of course the defendants are saying it's the other provision. There will be rules and logical analysis that will take the court to make a determination as to what provision applies.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't tell you offhand, but if it's the provision that the EPA is relying upon, applies, then the CPP will probably be able to go forward. I think it will may come down to something, a rule as simple as which was the first enrolled. Which was the first enrolled. And I think as a matter of logic, the first provision that was passed basically took away the category that the second provision makes more specific. So the second in time provision was actually a superfluity by the time it was passed. And I think that may, from what the reading I've done, may be the ultimate solution. But again, it's an issue of statutory construction, which follows rules of
law. Which means, as you say, the building of the law, what the law is made out of.
What the words actually mean. It's a close reading of the actual words. Reading of the actual words.
I find it amazing, even at my advanced age, that the fate of the world is going to hang on a typographical error or some goofball intern in 1988 who left two scraps of paper in the bill, and now we're all fighting about that little mistake that went way back then. Mm-hmm. Life is funny.
And when you think about the people trying to kill off the Clean Power Plan, you know, you talk about the Right to Die movement. They should call themselves the Right to Fry movement.
Well, okay, with that merriment, that pleasant thought, here we go. We'll have to – everyone, you can check out links to most of what we talked about here at the blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. Please leave us a comment. Tell us what you think about the show. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. Please share us with your friends so that they can hear about us. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio, and you can, of course, find us on iTunes. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And friend, thank you very much for taking the time to chat again. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you guys for listening. It's wonderful to have you here. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.